Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, it's Seattle guitarist Hillary Field. She's a presenter, an outstanding musician, and I met her with Matthew Cochran and Matthew McAllister on their thing. They have a sort of a round table, and I was invited to talk about the Bream Williams guitar duo, albums, recordings, stuff like that. And I had to sound smart, and I did my best. And I really liked her. And we got along so well, we decided to talk on the show. I hope you guys enjoy it. The show is sponsored by Savage Classical. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. You can go there and get the guitar of your dreams. Just tell them Big Diaper Brett sent you. That's Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com, savageclassical.com. On with the show, I'm going to be talking to Louis Trepanier. You remember him, right? From the Canadian Guitar Quartet. Well, him and I have become friends. And he's doing a project called Les 100, 100 pieces by Roland Dienz in celebration of the artist's life. And he's going to join me on the intro here to talk about that really quickly. And I hope you guys enjoy what I did. I played a piece called Blue Montuno. I think I'm saying it right. I think I'm saying things right. I think I'm saying Louis's name correctly. All that stuff. Anyway, I hope everything's good. I've been sitting here talking to my friend Paul today. We've been complaining about presenters, which is ironic because I'm having a presenter on the show today. But she's one of the good ones. She does the right thing. She writes you back when you write her. It's not that hard. People write me all the time for the show, not 20 times a day. Like this presenter said, this guy is sitting, this has happened to me twice in my career. It happened once 20 years ago. I won't tell you who it was, but the guy said I was harassing him. And he asked me where I got his number. And I said, I got your, all this stuff. So he didn't like getting, you know, back in the day, you used to call people. Well, they didn't like getting called. And there was a big sort of, you know, 1-2 punch between the two of us, and we got into it. But that was back in the day. Now I don't argue with anybody. It's not worth it. It's you younger guitarists, most of you are younger guitarists right now listening to this. It is absolutely not worth it to start a battle with someone professionally ever. Don't do it. It's not a good idea. I did it, and look at me now. I would always call people out on their bullshit, and here I am. So the thing is this guy wrote back and said that he receives 20 press kits a day and that he had received my, quote, numerous emails. And it drove me into a spiral of rage. And I called, who I call when I'm in a spiral of professional rage, my good friend Paul Smith, who we both went to Manus together. He's been on the show too. And he's doing wonderful things with Tune Up Philly and the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra down there. And, you know, he's a mover and a shaker. He's a hustler. You know, he tries to, you know, we try to do what we can with what we're given. I'm not saying hustler in a bad way. Anyway, I know I can always depend on Paul for a good complaint session. And we came up with some good ideas. We're going to talk more about them next week. So anyway, you know, I guess I can thank this presenter because through him, through the fires of my anger has been forged this beautiful stone that Paul and I are going to build together. And we're going to take over the whole world and we'll have all of you at our feet. Anyway, Hillary, just to be completely clear, Hillary Field, who is on the show today, outstanding guitarist. And an even more outstanding presenter, is a good presenter. She writes you back when you send her something, and she's nice and she's pleasant. And you're, hey, I don't know if I don't expect everybody to listen to everything that's sent to them, but at least be nice to about it. Thousands of dollars and thousands of hours are poured into those press kits. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of time that I spent just getting this one together. And I have somebody say he receives 20 of them a day. Ugh. Anyway, I'm cooled down now. Hey, let's have a good time. Let's talk to Louis Trepanier.
And then during the pandemic, it just occurred to me, you know, okay, it's not timely anymore because he's been gone for a few more years, but...
And something else is going on.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. Everybody's recording videos now. people either bought equipment to record their own pretty good videos during the pandemic, or everybody knows somebody who's a guitarist but also a videographer now. Or, you know, the other thing is nobody's getting paid
No.
for this. Everybody's just doing it because they heard the idea and they go, yeah, I'd like to put my face and my playing into this statement of here's, you know, just marking one of the important characters in our
And
community.
that's the thing, is that I'm saying we're looking at Ben Vettori, Dave Tanen, but these people don't do things for free. Dale
Usually not too
Kavanaugh.
much, no.
Yeah, I mean, so it's pretty interesting that they did it. I know, because you approached me, and I was like, and generally when people ask me to play something, I'm very hesitant because of the dystonia, and because I compose most of my stuff for that reason. So when I play other people's music, there's usually something I hit once in a while that I can usually work around, but it does take work to work around it.
They're all like intermediate level. They're all pretty short, but they're gems, every one of them. And I love the variety of like the very first video, like piece number one. So I was going to record that one just to get the project started. And I was talking to Russ D'Angelo, who was Roland's agent in the US and a really close friend for years. And I had a couple of really awesome, you know, 35, 40-minute phone conversations with him. And he said, you know, the piece is called On Joe's Deck. It says, there is a guy called Joe who plays guitar. Like, he could record this. And I said, well, we got to do that, you know? And Joe is, if I understood correctly, Joe is a medical doctor in some field. Like, I never asked what he does, but I think that's what it is. And he's been a, you know, sort of amateur guitarist all his life. Roland, when he would come to California, would hang with him and his wife. And he wrote a cello part because Barbara is a cellist, an amateur cellist. And so he put an extra cello part on this piece. So the first video is the two of them. And, you know, on Joe's deck, there's Joe on his deck playing away. And it's incredibly charming, you know. And you know, neither of them are big time professional players. And then, you know, a few videos in, you've got like one of our biggest stars, like Fabio Zanno. And actually, Fabio is the first person I asked when I started this project. And he said he didn't need any convincing or explaining. He got it. He says, yep, I'm in. You know, the old saying, there's no small parts, just small actors. You look at some of these tiny little pieces and the performances people have handed in, and people of all levels, like, you know, we've got some of, you know, we've got Dale Kavanaugh playing, and then we've got people, a few people who are like much younger or beginners, or there's even like one amateur in the group, you know, there's kind of a wide range of career profiles going on. And it's kind of cool. I think in a way, it really reflects Roland's sort of interests in different, like, in sense of humor in different neighborhoods and different ways of playing and stuff. So it's
Yeah,
kind of
this
a
is
nice
this.
tribute in a way.
Yeah, it is good. I think it's a good tribute. So make sure you continue to check out Lay 100 for updates from Louis Trepanier. It's on his webpage, Louis Trepanier, on his YouTube page, I mean to say. Lay 100 by Roland Deans. Proud to be a part of it. Also, I want to remind you to go to hillaryfield.com. That's hillaryfield.com for more information about this terrific guitarist that we're having on today. That's hillaryfield.com. And Aaron Largette Kaplan, old friend of the show, is going to be performing on April 15th in New York City at Barge Music. BARGEMUSIC. Barge Music. It is a storied venue that is a sort of flotilla. Am I using that word correct, or is that like a military term? It's like a floating, it's a barge. It's a barge, and people play classical music on it, looking at scenes of the New York skyline and being serenaded by our friend Aaron. It's an exciting program that'll feature a mix of music by Bach, John Cage, Spanish composers and contemporary composers, Anthony R. Green, Laurie Spiegel from NYC, Vinit Shendi, I think I'm saying that right, and a world premiere by Brooklyn composer Daniel Falsenfeld. Many of the selections are from Largette Kaplan's latest album, Honey Cadence, God's Time, music of J.S. Bach, and Spanish Candy, which will be out in June 2023. Spanish Candy is by far and away my favorite title of any classical guitar album I've ever heard. Spanish Candy. I love it. I love this guy. Make sure you go see him. That's April 15th, 2023. Also, you should go to the show. You should go to my website. It's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support so that I can feed my son when he comes out. That's right. He's going to come out just a month after Spanish Candy comes out. Wally's going to come out. And I have to be able to feed him. And I know that you don't want Wally to starve to death, right? So make sure that you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Okay, support the show. brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Aaron Larkat Kaplan is playing on April 15th, 2023. Make sure you go to hillaryfield.com and savageclassical.com and that you go to Louis Trepanier's YouTube page to look at Late 100 by Roland Dienz. I think I got everything this week. All right, let's get on with it. This is my time with guitarist Hillary Field. Okay, so Hillary, you're in Seattle, is that right?
Yes.
And that is by far and away, that is the one city that I would move out of New York for without even thinking twice.
Oh, really? So have you been here before?
I've been here once.
Yeah.
One time.
Must have had a good impression on you then.
Yeah. It did. What's your relationship with that city? How long have you been there?
Oh, I've been there. I've been here for quite a while. I moved pretty much like after college, and I moved. I am from New York. I grew up in Long Island, and I knew that I didn't want to, or I couldn't really stay in New York. Because I couldn't afford to live in New York City, and I did not want to live in Long Island, and I sort of wanted to get away. And a good friend of mine from college moved to Seattle, and she called me up and she said, I have this 2-bedroom apartment and I don't have a roommate, and would you like to come and live with me? And so I said, sure. So I just like gathered up the money that I could for a 1-way ticket. And
you had never been there?
I had been there, I think, once or twice before with some other friends, and also with this friend. And so I had been there, and I knew other people there as well. And so, yeah, I just got a 1-way ticket, and then I told my parents, and then I packed a suitcase and took my guitar and got on a plane and stayed. Then eventually came back, got my rest of my stuff. And
wait, so maybe I missed something, but did you go to college here first, or did you?
I went to college in New York at Stony Brook University.
Oh, okay, good. What was his name that was there?
Jerry Willard.
Yeah, he was there forever. He just retired,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Great guy. So you studied with Jerry Willard then.
I did, yes.
And you went to college. Did you do pre-college work over there too? Because you were so close.
No, I did. I did start college pretty early, though. I started actually at age 16.
Wow, that's like Doogie Howser. That's really something.
Yeah, it was just one of these things that I wouldn't recommend it. Now,
yeah, like, absolutely
for young
not.
People, it's because I was young in my grade, and then I kind of did a couple of things that, you know, in 1 year, and I wouldn't recommend it because even if you could do it, it's good. I think it's better to be older and to have some life experience before you go into this other environment where everything could be a little big and overwhelming.
I think so. I think I went to junior college, and it was over. It felt huge. It felt like I was in a small town.
I mean, it was fine. I did fine, but yeah. I wouldn't recommend it. I would say, you know, if you're 16, 17, 18, stay in high school, you know, and do all the things that high school kids do and be in that protected environment before like branching out. So.
Why did you leave high school so early, if you don't mind me asking? Because was it because of the guitar? It just like you were told you needed to get on top of that? Or what happened?
My parents kind of moved. They moved from one neighborhood to another neighborhood in Long Island. And then like in the second neighborhood, they weren't crazy about being in that other place. And I guess my parents or my mom thought that it would be better if I just like started college. So I didn't have enough information to, or
To argue with them.
Yeah. Argue with them. I didn't have enough information. I didn't have the skills to argue with my parents about something like that. So, I mean, now as, you know, as a full grown adult, I could say, it's much better for a teenager to be, you know, a young teenager to be in high school.
That's and the idea.
Friends with other people her own age and kind of go through that. And there's plenty of time. There's no rush.
Yeah, it sort of sounded like they sent you to like free boarding school or like low cost boarding school.
Yeah, there are a lot of kids in my house. So I think that it's like, let's see how we can.
There are a lot of kids in your house. How many kids?
Well, four kids. So
that's a lot. No, that's a lot. There were three of us and it felt crowded. In a small house, you know,
Yeah, my parents are kind of eager for us to like
move on. Well, how was Jerry Willard with that? You know, you're 16. You were studying with him then, or did you?
Yeah. So I was studying with him as well.
Because he seems like kind of like the kind of guy that if I was 16, I'd feel nice around. I'd feel safe with.
And right. Stuff. Also, I knew Jerry. So growing up on Long Island, I also went to this place called the Guitar Workshop. And so Jerry taught there. And my teacher, Pasquale Bianculli, Pat Bianculli.
Pat Bianculli.
Yeah. So he was he was a student of Jerry and he was studying there. And so I had lessons from him and I had lessons from Jerry. You know, I did my best. But I just, you know, I did my best.
Yeah.
But I definitely stayed in touch with them, you know, through all these years. And like every time I had a CD, you know, I'd send it to them and thank them on my CDs.
Yeah.
And then I did get to see Jerry in person after all those years, like as an adult. And I met him in New York City, like at a diner. And he's like, oh my goodness, like she's all grown up. Like she's all grown up and she's, you know, married and she's got a kid of her own and all. Like, so
all the best stuff seeing those guys after all those years.
Yeah.
Seeing an old teacher is the best. And the fact that you had a relationship with both your childhood teacher and your sort of teen / college teacher was really, you guys were all together.
So I was definitely, I had a lot of support that way.
Yeah.
I did, like in that little guitar program. In the bigger programs, like, you know, when you take other classes outside of the music program, that could be quite overwhelming, you know, like in the lecture halls. They have these big lecture halls with no windows and just.
I agree. I have the same. I went to Texas for undergrad, and my favorite classes were the ones that were taught by the teacher's assistants, as you said.
Yeah.
The TAs and I had.
I felt like I could connect more, and I could learn more, and I could understand, and I could see them, you know, instead of like being so far away, and they're just like this little.
Yeah.
It's like being in a big concert hall.
It's like being in a concert hall, but the guy's just talking about a wounded knee. It's like, there's no, I'm talking about something that there should be some sort of dialogue about, interaction about.
Yeah.
I think it's just colleges just sort of hire these big names that have written books and stuff.
And then
they don't have time for us. You know?
Yeah, there's this one professor, and what he did in his lectures is he just read from a book. And he said, I wrote this book.
And so I'm going to read it.
Read from the book that he wrote. But that's all that he did.
That's an awful thing to do.
Yeah. So, but again, I didn't have the wherewithal to say, like, you know.
Well, we both know. Everybody knows at this point, the sort of veil has been lifted. And especially if you go to college, you find out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Especially in music college, where you have these great musicians, these incredible musicians. You listen to their albums, you're like, this is an incredibly expressive person. And then you get taught by them or you take a masterclass with them. You're like, this is the most dull, dry person.
Sometimes happens.
And should not really be teaching. And yet those are the people that are in these positions are the people that, you know, it should be equal parts communication and skill when it comes to being a professor.
Right.
But it's not. And that's okay. And there's nothing that you or I can do to change that.
Right. It happened. And I got what I, you know, as I said, like,
We got things. Yeah.
The guitar department was really, really super supportive. Like the music and the music program was smaller, but like outside of that, like the college life part a lot, but you know, that's going to a big school. So like my daughter went to Amherst College in Massachusetts.
Right.
Small liberal arts.
Yeah.
And she had this wonderful experience, and you know, she went through, you know, all of high school, you know, age appropriate And
yeah, the whole thing. She went when she was 18, like everybody else.
Right.
Well, the thing is, you also had to send her across the country. Like your parents had to watch you go to Seattle. Probably, you know, if you entered college early, then you're out of there at 20. So at 20 years old, you know, you're floating over across the. That must have been hard for them. I know that it's probably hard for you. Is she there now in Amherst?
Emma, actually, my daughter, she graduated Amherst. And now she got a Fulbright scholarship and she's in Taiwan.
Oh my God.
Teaching English.
I think you told me about that the last time we talked. If people didn't see it, you and I were on a sort of a little panel talking about the John Williams, Julian Bream duo.
Yeah.
It was so much fun.
So much fun. So great.
With the Matthews.
With the Matthews.
Exactly. Cochran and McAllister. So that was a fun combo. And then that's where we kind of met. We never met in person.
Not in person.
But I do want to go out to Seattle. I think I had mentioned that Liz, my wife, was up for a job at Amazon. And of course they dragged it on, as Amazon does, for about 2 months. I was literally saying goodbye to people. It was that bad. I've lived here for 20 years. And I just got super excited about Seattle. I was just like, you know what? This is going to be great.
It is
after,
great.
It's after 20 years here. Yeah.
I can look to my left and see the Cascade Mountains. You know, I just like right outside my window. It's amazing.
And you look to your left and there's coffee shops and restaurants and everything else.
Right. Everywhere, bookstores. And then on the look to the right, I don't see it from my house, but there's the Olympic Mountains on the other side and there's Mount Rainier and there's like Washington. And it's just a gorgeous place everywhere you go. It's really gorgeous and it's a lot more of a milder situation than living in New York or living in New York City. Like in New York City, you know, because there's so many people, like walking down the street for me in New York City, I always feel like I'm bumping into people because there's so many, like you're always like kind of bumping. And I've definitely experienced very, very, very kind people in New York City as well. Like I remember once just like walking down the street and like some money fell out of my pocket and then a whole bunch of people just like, hey, you know, like went to give it back to me and stuff. And
that's the truth. Yeah. It's not the pickpocketer's paradise that the movies paint. I've never had anything stolen from me. There was one time on the train, somebody was trying to get something out of my, one time in 20 years.
Well, I think you do have to be on alert, you know, it will happen. Yeah. But it's just such a big city that there's all kinds of people. And,
Did you ever live in the city or did you mostly?
But I lived on Long Island. My husband's also from New York. And his mom now lives in, on the Upper West Side. So we go and visit.
Well, the bumping is something that it took me about 6 months. Cause when I moved here, I would bump into people. And then I realized I was like, oh, I have to be on, it's like traffic. You're supposed to be on the right. Supposed to move to the right and go that way. And on escalators, that's true for everybody that's listening. You don't stand on the left side of the escalator. If you're going to stand, you go to the right, get out of the way.
All these unwritten rules about how to get around.
And then it takes a while to figure that out unless somebody tells you. Yeah. But as far as Seattle, you love it there. I mean, and you're okay with the no sun thing.
Well, it's sunny.
It seems sunny.
It's trying to come out right now, but actually I am. For a couple of reasons. When the sun comes out, it's amazing. So you're just like really happy and like you have to get outside, you know, go for a walk. It's like it's an ordeal. And when the sun comes out and the sky is clear, it's so beautiful. The other thing is that like when it's overcast and cloudy, then it's like, oh, like you can do all these comfy things, like stay inside and play music, read books, you know, drink tea or I'm not a coffee drinker, but that's a big coffee town.
You're not a coffee drinker in Seattle. Yeah. You're not a coffee drinker.
I know.
That's insanity. That's sacrilegious.
I know.
But it is good for you not to drink coffee. It's great for us as performers, as guitarists to not drink coffee, I think is an advantage.
Well, that's the thing is that I think I once tried and like my heart was going really fast and I'm like, this isn't fun for me at all. So I have a lower tolerance for.
Well, that's like Ricardo Cobo brings a cup of coffee with him on stage sometimes. I've seen it. I've seen it happen twice.
Yeah.
And I just am like, what on earth is this guy? No fear. There's no way I would ever do that. Well, let's talk about your guitar work because there is several, there's, you know, a couple of decades of it.
Yeah.
And we're spanning back to 1993 with your first sort of release. of music of Spain and South America. Incredible, you know, an incredible performance, an incredible sort of recital album. And it's something that everybody should listen to. And we go all the way through, you know, you have a couple of pit stops with a singer called Patrice O'Neill, who
that's,
we can talk
that's about. That's when I had a baby.
Really? Oh, because it's sort of like lullabies, right? Barracudas and stuff.
Yeah. And so that's when I had my daughter. And I just had this urgency to record, arrange and record lullabies. Something was just driving inside of me that I had to do this thing.
Well, not only that, but it's also a ensemble album.
Yeah,
it's like a jazz right, sort of almost pop elements are in it. And orchestration too. You've got the drummer
orchestration
and the,
so it was a little different foray for me. And it's interesting because when I love those two CDs, Siente and Cantilena, that I did with Patrice. She just has this gorgeous voice. And so it was this big project of mine. And at the time, like when I was working on them, it's like 2006 or something. And that was before the turn of like YouTube and like when music, like before that, like music was out, like you released it, like have a distributor, you know, it would go to certain places. But then it's like it exploded, like the whole digital explosion. So everything is everywhere. And so we did all these pieces, all these songs from around the world, which is fine for me, you know, as an instrumentalist. But then Patrice, with this beautiful voice, I tell her, you know, okay, I've got some songs from Sweden and Japan, you know, and Czech and all this stuff. And she's like, great. But, you know, the thing is that she has to learn the language.
The diction.
The diction. Yeah. So she put a lot of work into that and Russian. And so, like, I remember this is my daughter was little and, like, before bed, like, I had these, like, big books from the library, these lullaby books. And so I'd go through them with her and we'd pick out lullabies that she liked, you know, and that we would do. And so, like, we ended up doing this one Russian lullaby. And my daughter, she'd say to me, like when the album was going to come out, like, oh, now all the little babies in Russia, they can sit in their high chairs and eat their borscht and listen to your songs, mommy. And I'm like, sure, you know, because, and then it's like YouTube exploded and everything. And it's like, okay, like little babies in Russia are listening, you know, okay, it'll be distributed in the US or whatever, or maybe like, you know, in Europe or whatever, but, yeah, and then like everything exploded. It's like, yes, it is all over the world. So.
It's true. You know, there's something to be said for that because we complain a lot on this show about, I mean, it comes up often, especially when we talk about people's albums.
Yeah.
Because it brings back all those memories of distribution issues,
right,
all these other things you're thinking and like, oh, and I can't sell them anymore. And it, you know, it naturally starts to come up when we're talking about this. But the thing that I do like about this little age is that there are people listening to this show in India. There are people listening to this show in Iran.
Yeah.
And it's not like there's, you know, it's not like, oh, there's so much, but it's, even if it's just a couple of people, that always makes me just go like, oh, this is great. This is a great thing.
The outreach is amazing. I totally agree. And for educational purposes, you can hear almost anything with just a click. It's amazing.
I know.
So
it is amazing. And it kind of, it's like the kids, it's got to have a part in why these young guitarists are so much better than they were when I was young.
They have so many resources.
Yeah.
And there's so much you can just learn from online, just like with a click and you can just learn it.
Why aren't we smarter?
I remember when YouTube came out and I was just amazed because I'm thinking you can see people's fingerings. Like you can watch a David Russell performance and see his fingerings and like, how valuable is that, you know, to, in terms of learning.
I would have paid.
What?
I remember like signing up for like the Grove or like getting a Grove dictionary, considering getting the whole thing. And I was like, should I spend $2,500 on this, and now it's right there. It's pretty crazy.
Crazy.
I don't know if we sound like fuddy-duddies, but it is crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts. For me, I feel like I had the joy of discovery. Mm-hmm. Like, I know, like, with my young students, you know, they just take for granted that, like, with a click or with just saying, you know, Siri, or, you know, that they can get anything that they want. You know, mm-hmm. they want to hear a song, they just ask their computer or their phone to play it. And streaming music, everything is available to them all the time. And so they're kind of used to that. But I'm kind of grateful that I had that joy of discovery, like, when these things came out.
Yeah, there's an adventure to it, to going into the library and putting the headphones on and putting the you know, the laser disc of Don Giovanni in and watching it in a little cubicle.
Yeah, I definitely did a lot of that. You know, I just, like, go to the music library, put headphones on, and listen to, like, John Williams play Bach, like, every day.
Uninterrupted, too. Not like listening to it now where, like, you know, when I was listening to your albums, I also was, like, doing the dishes, and I was, like, taking the subway, and I was cleaning, and, you know, which is, you know, that's good. We can do that, but it's a completely different experience than the sort of, like, open the score, listen along sort of thing that was demanded of us. That was, I mean, that's what they told us to do if we were going to be serious musicians. When you, you know, you have sort of a, at this point, you've been at, is it Northwestern Pacific University? Is that the name of it, or is Seattle Pacific University?
Yeah, well, I was teaching at Pacific Lutheran University, mm-hmm. and at Seattle Pacific University, I was teaching at both of those schools. Yeah. I'm no longer at the universities, and again, it's just like a change in my life when I, you know, got married and had a child, and then I just decided that I just wanted a change in my life at that point, and I didn't want to spend so much time commuting back and forth to the schools. But then I changed over and I started teaching a lot of kids, which is at that time. Because I hadn't done that before, I didn't really see ahead to how amazing it would be to take a child, you know, from when they're just starting out and young, maybe preschool, kindergarten, and mm-hmm. then, like, through their school age years, and then, you know, and watching them develop and grow and having this relationship, you know, with these particular people. And it's just amazing. It's so fulfilling to me to go through that.
I completely, I don't know if you know this about me, but that is all I do too. I just do the kids, and I've been doing it for 25 years at this point. It really is. At first it was sort of, because I never was really, I was in a college, a junior college, for like a second. But at first I was a little like, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to be the guy that teaches the kids? I wish I could teach at college. Why are there no college jobs? You know?
Yeah.
And at this point, I would say, like, the last probably 7 or 8 years, I've just loved it. I've just loved building these relationships. You get better at it. You get more patient as you get older. And that's the main thing, is the patience. And I have that now. And having the relationship not only with the kids, but with these families. And they're so grateful.
Right. They are. Yes. Yes. And so I've done both, you know, the colleges and also teaching children. Yeah. And they both definitely have their benefits. And when I left the colleges, it wasn't to leave the students, it was to leave that sort of life of, like, having to get in my car, you know, in the morning and then be gone all day, you know, come back, like, leave at 6 a.m, come back like 8 p.m. And then, like, having this child at home that I really wanted to see. It would be like my motivation, like, on the freeway to get home was like, get to see my baby. So yeah, for me, that was the impetus. And then, because I had a young child, it's like I was around a lot of parents with young children, and so they just kind of came to me. It just sort of developed that way, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful for like everyone that I've taught. I feel like I've learned so much, and I get so much out of it, and I'm happy, like, they inspire me and I inspire them, and I'm just happy for this relationship.
Exactly. I, you know, that's not only that, but I, you know, what's your daughter's name? Is it Emily?
Emma.
Emma. Did you teach Emma guitar? Because I, you know, I'm having a kid. We talked about it before, but I'm having one on July in July.
Congratulations.
I thank you very much. I don't think my wife is like, she's like, do you really want to teach it guitar? And I'm like, I do. I think I do. I want to teach him. Yeah. But what do you think? Did she learn any instruments? Does she have any relationship?
Well, I did not teach her guitar. I actually took her to another guitar teacher.
Yeah.
And she took piano and viola and singing voice. And she plays also ukulele. She sort of has her own musical adventure that she wanted to be different than her parents, because my husband also plays guitar. So she chose ukulele because, well, she says it's like only four strings and it's smaller. So like she has small hands, so she can get around and she likes it better. And also I think she's maybe overloaded with guitars like all over the house and, you know, all over her.
All over her head. Yeah, she's just like, I've had enough of this.
But that's the background music of my life. But she's great. She's very musical. Like I remember when she was little and I thought, oh, like I'll get her like a little toy piano that plays music for her, because I think she's trying to play like Kraszak or something like that. And so we went to the toy store and she just sat down with the little toy piano and started playing the music by herself. Like the piano wasn't playing it for her. She just like sat down at the keys and just started like playing tunes, like Are You Sleeping, and little tunes that she knew. I'm like, okay, so let's go for this, you know, let's try it. And so she she's got this great ear. And so she started piano when she was pretty young, and she did that. And then in fourth grade she did viola. She played in orchestra, and then, like I said, ukulele. And so she's a great singer, and she's always like in the school musicals and college musicals and plays. She has this other adventure with music. And at Amherst, she also took music theory classes, but it was never something that she wanted to do like as a career, full time, or professionally. It's just it's something that she loves to do.
So you gave her that space. You weren't.
Yeah. And for me, I didn't teach her because, I like that, like giving her that space.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be mom, without necessarily being.
Well, there's already, I think that's true, because I think Liz, I have parents that, a lot of parents these days are allowing their kids to swear, right? Which is completely not something I experienced growing up. Yeah. It was just like, none of us swore. Yeah. Or we did. We definitely swore, but if we got caught for it, it was lights out, right? Yeah. You get grounded. And I think that there's just something to, there's so many demands on the kids right now.
Yeah.
That I think those parents are just like, I cannot also police whether they're using the F word or not. Like, I don't care. It's just like, and I think that was maybe, I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened with you, but I can say, I can understand the idea of there's other things that I want to focus on as a parent.
Yeah.
And then being a disciplinarian, which is what it takes to make somebody an active young classical guitarist, you know?
Yeah. And being a parent, there's a different dynamic working with your kid than working with, you know, a child who's not your own.
Yeah, it's like a psychologist trying to treat their husband or something.
it's a different dynamic. So, I think it's best to just, like you said, just give them that space. So yeah, about swearing too. I remember my daughter when she was a teenager. She came to me and asked about that. Because she's very smart.
She said, "Mom, verbal. Can I please just start swearing?
I need to swear." I just want my thoughts were. And so I told her, and she would never do this, like never use it as a weapon against anybody, like never at anybody. And don't use it in a public place where it might offend somebody else who might be listening in the background, like those two things. But I think she wanted to like use it in her writings, you know, like in her like creative writing.
Sure.
Or with your friends, you know, whatever. But So I just told her those two things, and that's just be like consideration, and that I think that's how she would be anyway, you know.
Right. It's an early lesson in not weaponizing things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Never use it to someone, like against someone, you know, like that. And that's no matter what, that's like a rule. Like don't.
That I think that's a good rule for all of this stuff.
Yeah.
For almost everything you do, if it's not done in anger or meanness, then you're usually not super safe, but you know, watch your mouth. But then
it's an expression. It's a verbal expression.
It is. So. Then it's a verbal expression. I agree. So with that, you know, one of the things, you know, that keeps coming up is Emma and how important she is, how big of a part she is in your life. And it must have been difficult then when in 2015, you decide to do what is arguably your most ambitious project, the Premieres album, right?
Right.
It's a large album with like 9 contemporary tonal composers, which I'm always a fan of. I'm really a fan of tonal, new tonal music. I'm just sort of, whenever anybody is sort of pushing these guys forward, it's great. And I have a personal relationship with Victor Kalafidis.
You do? Okay.
Right. I do.
He's New York. Yeah.
He's just the sweetest guy in the world.
I can imagine.
You just talked to him?
No, I've had email contact with him when I was working on this music.
I fell in love with his mandolin because he writes for the mandolin.
Right.
And I really liked his mandolin music. And he used to be the director at the Trinity Concert Series, which is something that I played when I was young.
Yeah.
And I had him on the show once and I had a good time with him. And then I loved his music so much, the next time he released something about 6 years later, I'd forgotten that I had him on the show, and I had him on the show again.
Okay.
And I'm halfway through the interview and I go, Jesus, did I already interview you? And he goes, yeah. And I go, that's my rules. I don't interview people twice. And I go, but let's do it. He's the only person besides Fred Hand, who I studied with, one of my best friends. Yeah. Just recently, I broke that rule with him. But up till then, Victor Kalafidis was the only person who'd been on the show twice.
And
it was because I didn't know about it. And I was happy to interview him again.
Okay.
And he was just the best about it. He was like the sweetest guy ever. He was like, let's go on a bike ride. We never did. We should. And now he's sort of like a dean at a college. Not even with music. But we were talking about sort of the tonal music. Mm-hmm. And we both sort of clapped and, you know, made a big thing out of it. What are your feelings about that as far as like atonality and sort of?
For me, I feel like if I'm going to work on something and I'm going to share it with the world, mm-hmm. it has to resonate with me first.
Yeah.
I have to feel it. Like I have to feel it inside my heart in order for me to offer it outside of myself to anyone else. And so, the music that I chose for Premieres, all of that music, I chose it. And also some of it was composed after I asked for music from composers, but I knew their work. It all resonated inside my heart. And I could not feel that with certain, atonal music. And I know it's a spectrum, you know, it's like,
absolutely. Yeah.
Where you can, go from completely tonal to, you know, going outside of the box at certain levels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do love dissonances, but if there's some music where it's just like, I'm not finding the tune.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who's a composition professor said, I mean, he might've been quoting somebody else that like inside of music, you need to find the song and the dance.
Mm.
So like if I couldn't get the hook for me, then I don't feel like I could really do it justice. Other people could do it justice because it resonates inside their hearts. But first it has to mean something to me. I have to feel it.
Yeah.
And I know that there's ways to broaden your perspective, and actually working with Jerry when I was in college, like he was trying to broaden me that way as well. But still, even to this day, it's like I know what what I really love, and that's what I'm going to put my time into, and that's what I'm going to put my heart and my soul into. And so that's that. Then that became, you know, the premier CD. And the other focus of the CD, and this was actually my husband's idea to start, was to record music that had never been recorded before, hence the name.
Wow.
And so that you're just offering this repertoire, you know, to bring it out into the world, and like adding to the repertoire that way in a recorded form, so people can hear it and go, oh, I've never heard that before, but that sounds so cool, I want to play it too, or I want to listen to it, or I want to look for more music by these composers, or, you know, like just to get it out there.
And that is exactly what happens when we listen to these recordings, not just yours, but anytime somebody deals with a new composer or a composer that's underrepresented. And I don't mean that in any sort of political way, even though I feel that that is an issue. Mm-hmm. But I do, I think that, you know, there is sort of like, these are all people, like these are all premieres. You know, Victor's out there riding his bike around, you know, New Jersey right now. Like, these are normal people that right. That you don't hear about very much. And the importance of that, of people playing that music and playing the music that does speak to them.
Yeah.
Is I think really going to be what moves us forward and what changes things. Did you have a relationship with Jorge Morel? You played his music on your debut album too.
Yes. I think that almost all of my CDs, except for the Lullaby CDs, have music by Jorge Morel. And
that's great. He's great. I mean, he's incredible.
Yeah, he's like one of my most favorite composers in the world. And I just remember when I first heard his music for the very first time, I was just like, I thought I have to play that. But then I wish that I was that music. Like, I wish that I wrote it. I wish that, you know, like, it was just so much to me. And
About tune and dance.
Yeah.
You know, there it is.
So I just went about, like, you know, just learning his music and studying it and practicing it. And I knew I wanted to put it on my first CD when I was recording my CD. And I recorded that with Kevin Callahan. Do you know Kevin?
I don't.
Composer, guitarist in Seattle. He's amazing. So he was the producer of that CD. And so, yeah, I recorded the Sonatina, like my favorite piece ever, at that point, and put it on my CD. So here's the story. So this CD, Music of Spain and Latin America, it came out before like everything exploded, you know, like with YouTube and Facebook and everything. And so we put out the CD, and I needed to get, I need to work on like the copyright, you know, publishing, paying the publishers for
right.
all of that legal stuff.
Yeah.
And so we wrote to all the publishers, you know, with, we're going to release the CD, and about, you know, paying the royalties. And so the publisher of Jorge Morel's music was Ashley Mark at the time, and Maurice Summerfield, that's who it was.
Mm.
And so what did we do? Like, we wrote to the publisher, sent the CD, and asked about the royalty rates for the Sonatina. Plus, I think I had like five other pieces by Morel on that CD too. I had Danzas para Amigo and Danza Brasileira. So we asked for the royalty rates, you know, that we could pay. And then we got contacted back by Maurice Summerfield and he was like a close friend of Jorge Morel, and how much he loved the music and that he wanted to distribute it, you know, through his company over in England. And he took that.
He's Guitar Magazine, Classical Guitar.
Yeah,
Magazine.
Yeah, right, right. And he took out like a big ad in his magazine mm-hmm. for it. And he sent the music, he sent it to Jorge Morel to listen to. And so I heard that and I'm like, because at that point, you know, like before there was all this digital communication, like, and I was like way too shy to like try to contact a composer and say, hey, I love your music and I'm playing it. You know, it's like, and so I heard that that happened, that this person sent my music to my idol, you know, like my favorite composer. Mm-hmm. And so every day, like, yeah, so I guess like a week later, I got a letter in the mail from Jorge Morel, and he told me like how much he loved my my interpretation of his piece and best wishes for my career and this beautiful letter, and I was just like in seventh heaven, and I think he called me on the phone too, and then we got to meet because we came to New York and we met him. He was living in Queens. And he gave me music, like this sheet music to play. It was the guitar and string quartet that ended up on Ballad Stories on my next CD. And you have to remember like what went on what CD. Yeah, so on my first CD was the Sonatina and the Romance Criollo and Danza Brasileira. And the Danzas para Amico went on my second CD along with some other pieces and the lullaby, the Berceuse. So I did that music. And so I kept in touch with him through these years and always putting his music on my CDs and being in close contact with him. And then there was a time when, he moved to Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Chile to do a concert tour. And on the way back, the plane stopped in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of arranged it that I just like stayed in Florida and I met my sister and my niece there. And then we went to Jorge Morel's house in Florida in Orlando, mm-hmm. met him and his daughter. And he said to me, I have a secret or I have a surprise, but I'm not good at keeping secrets. So he took out this pad of music paper with like penciled in notes.
Yeah.
And said, this is for you. I am writing this.
And to get that at that time, because, you know, Renee Izquierdo was taken care. I mean, not taken care, but that's one of the reasons that he moved down there was his daughter. Yeah. And they were all sort of, you know, helping out with him. Right.
Yeah.
And so you go down there and that's right before he died then. Two, 3 years before he died, something like that.
No, there was more time.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember he was in New York until about like 2009, 2010, something like that.
So this was like the early 2010s or 2012 or 15, around in there. So he had this music for me. Yeah. So that was, that just lifted my heart. And so that was Ecos del Sur, and that ended up on Premieres. And before that, right before he moved, I think I went with my daughter and husband to visit him in New York before he moved. And I didn't have my guitar, but he wanted me to play for him. And so I was playing Suite for Olga. I was working on that. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that at that point he was composing music, but he wasn't playing it.
Yeah, sure.
He was, too old to really do all, you know, have that kind of dexterity. And so he asked me to play it for him. And so here I was in his apartment in New York, playing his guitar, playing his music that he's hearing on guitar for the first time. And that was another time when I just like disassociated, like I just came out of my body, like, oh, this is like the most amazing experience in the world, you know, like.
Yeah, we take those. I mean, we shouldn't take those for granted, should we, Hillary? Because we get those and other people don't. The 9-to-5ers and the people who, the money grabbers, the good people, but the money, they don't get those experiences. They pay for those experiences, you know?
Cruises. I think we really get this heart-to-heart experience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and even the fact that, you know, we play this instrument that's made out of wood that used to be a tree that was alive.
It was a tree. Yeah.
And had leaves and gave to the universe. And now it's giving life as an instrument to music that lived inside somebody else's heart. And that person might or might not be with us anymore. And they're still, that part of them is still alive.
Like
it just keeps living, you know?
It does.
Yeah,
It
so
does.
like
It's
what
all these,
kind
it's all it, it, an intertangling of living objects all coming together
of yeah.
for a common goal. It's
Yeah.
pretty, I mean, the relationship between composer, instrument, and performer, all those things, and audience.
An audience, yeah. The moment when, the music is connecting, you're connecting with the music, connecting with the audience, they're connecting with the music and connecting with
You
you.
must have been thinking about these things when you did that album, the premiere album. And the reason I brought it up in context of, because we're kind of coming to the end here of the interview, but I want to make sure we talk about this because the context of this album is this is 2015. So this is sort of your post daughter album. This is sort of like, right? This is sort of, I mean, and there's a certain
Teenager.
depth to it. You know, as far as it's a concept album, and it works really well as a non-concept album. It's very listenable.
Thank you.
How did that feel? Kind of making something like this while, I'm assuming Emma was, you know, a teenager at this
A
point, right?
teenager,
Wow. Yeah, so it was an important album for you. It must have been very personal and important. A
Very, very.
reconnection with yourself as an artist, I would imagine, after raising a child. Yeah.
So like I said, like if you ask my daughter about her growing up life, and she'd say, classical guitar is the soundtrack of my life,
For better or for worse.
So she heard a lot of mom practicing. But yeah, the connection and the fact that I connected with all of the composers on the album. And I didn't have that opportunity or take that opportunity with my previous albums, that this one, like I would I haven't met them all in person. Some I have not. But for each composer I talked with or wrote notes with, asked about their music, maybe they'd give me some things to look at, or they would write something for me. I'd work on it. And also for each piece, when I recorded it, I would send them the first mix, like the
Oh,
recording
wow.
of it,
And make
and
sure that they liked it. Yeah.
get feedback from them.
Wow.
And occasionally there would be something that I would do over. Like for instance, like in the Morel piece that he wrote for me, he I think he wanted a different sort of retard at one of the at the conclusion of one of the pieces. He wanted a different level of slowdown.
Yeah.
And so I think what I did is like I just recorded like a bunch of the endings, like to ask him like better like this, better like that, like what would you like? And then yeah, so I did that. And also with Victor, with his piece, and the mimos, and there's the aria, and he had a metronome marking, which like in the recording I just had that like two measures of click in my headphones, like to get that
Yeah.
tempo. And then I played it, and then I sent that to him in the slower movement, and he listened to it, and he said he really wanted it to like be like a little more graceful and just like take some more time with it.
Right.
Like he didn't want it
He didn't
necessarily.
want that metronome in your head.
Right. There wasn't a metronome in my ear while I played, just like two clicks before I
Right.
started.
Yeah.
But he didn't want me to like say, okay, that's a tempo, that's what I'm gonna play. He wanted me to just really move with it. And
Hey,
so
look,
I
yeah,
said,
it's incredible.
I can do that. I can do that much better than like trying to match tempo. So yeah, I recorded that and it was so much better. And he loved it after that, and I loved it after that. And so I was like, that's a good call. And so yeah, so for every single piece on that album went to the composer before the final mix, before the final thing. And so I knew
Yeah.
also in my heart that, you send these things out and people, of course, everybody has their opinion. They're entitled to all their opinions. But I knew that in the opinion of the composers, the people that where the music came from, that they appreciated how I interpreted their music.
No, and that's the real boss. Yeah. That's the
Because
only
if
actual
not,
critic.
I gave them all kinds of opportunities to tell me. And so I just worked with them until it was like, yeah, this is it. And so, of course, that's what interpretation is. I mean, everybody who plays the same piece is going to do it a little bit differently because you put yourself into it. But mm-hmm. if it speaks to the music and if it's telling a story, you know, then that's all great. And then people can absorb it the way that they want to. So, so for this particular CD, that really is very close to me that way.
I completely agree because, you know, especially with metronome markings, it's hard when you have a composer that's living or somebody that was living just a little while ago. It's hard to sort of say like, oh, that's at 58. I just, you know, I don't really want to play it there. Yeah. I want to be more rubato with it and be more expressive. But, you know, I was just playing this Dien's piece for this project that this guy's doing. And it says 58, but then it says expressivo.
Yeah.
And then I'm just like, but I'm wanting to stick to that 58 because it says it. And I don't want to mess it up. And I don't want anybody to say it's messed it up.
Fine line.
And Dien's is gone. And so I'm afraid somebody's going to be like, that's not 58. That's, you know, 60 and that's 40 or whatever. But it's hard when you're playing a living, well, really any composer. You just want to do what they tell you to do. And that's, and with the new composers, we have talked about how great they are, but there is a lot of direction there that I think wasn't in older music. There's a lot to post 1950.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just printing is easier to do, or the distribution is easier for them. But there's this Dien's piece has, it's just, he tells you exactly what to do all the time. And it's a little overwhelming.
I think he had a reputation for.
Oh, did he really? Because
For like micromanaging every little
and
thing.
And wanting you to stick to it, which I understand. I appreciate that. Yeah. But yeah, we also just have to do what we can do and what we want to do. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what's going on in the future for you? You know, what's happening with you these days?
I have some music that's been, I have recorded and it's sort of like in safekeeping. I do plan on doing another project. Some stumbling blocks as I'm thinking like, how do you release music now? How do people consume music now? But I think I do want to do another project. So I have a new piece that Jorge Morel wrote for me and that's not been recorded. And I think it was like 2018 or something. And he sent me this music and the title is For Hillary. And it's like 5-6 movements. And I did an audio recording of it. Did a video recording of it, and I did have a chance to work with Jorge on it before he passed away, and I did a whole version of it, and he gave me notes, and I did it all over again, and then I sent it to him, and this I think was like when the pandemic started, and he says that it was, you know, this was great, this was lovely, you know, I love the way that you played it, and so it's like okay. Like I did this. So I have that. And I have music that I have composed. I did a project called Ode to Hope, and it's based on the Pablo Neruda poem, Oda a la Esperanza, which means Ode to Hope. And so like there's around 5 movements now. And so I just took words from that poem and wrote a piece, like a movement from all of those different words, like the sea, the sky, the earth, hope, all will be fulfilled. So I just took lines and words from that poem. And so I have that whole suite and actually that came from a poetry project that I did with the poet laureate for Washington State, Claudia Castro Luna. And with this project, I asked her to offer me poems based on the theme of hope. And I'd write music to her poems. And then we performed those together, sort of like a duet, and, you know, where I wrote the music that and where the words would go. And then with this Pablo Neruda poem, which she would read while I played. I have a bunch of music that I've composed and music that's already been recorded and not like out yet. So I plan on doing a project with this and then performing I think like once I get another project out, then I'll feel like, you know, COVID kind of just put like a...
Absolutely. Yeah. It's hard to get back into the performing. I mean, I've been trying to, people are backed up, you know, people have, they're still presenting. I mean,
definitely.
You're a presenter and you know, you're getting all sorts of stuff from people. And it's like, I've been sending my stuff out there and it's like, you got to catch up. And they got to catch up. They got a lot going on.
Right. And also like for all those years, it's like, do I want to get on a plane? Do I want to like be in this situation?
100%. Yeah. It's like you have to all of a sudden hustle again after taking 3 or 4 years off hustling, and hustling is not easy.
Yeah. So, so I want to have this project, and then I've been talking, some people have been talking to me about their festivals, like another festival in Latin America and one in Spain, like to go and travel again. So, yeah, so I'll be doing like more local concerts and then out, you know, throughout the U.S. and then you know abroad, so those are my plans, just to get right back into it.
Well, I can't wait to hear your composition, because obviously you did the arrangements for the Lullaby International Lullaby project you did with Patrice O'Neill, who is also a famous comic. So if you Google Patrice O'Neill, you got to dig through the great Patrice O'Neill, who was an amazing comic, but that's not who you were writing with.
Yeah, was very confusing for a while.
Poor Patrice O'Neill. She must've been like, there's no way.
Like opposites. So anyway, so
No, go ahead. She's what? I didn't mean to cut you off.
She's got this beautiful ethereal voice.
She does, yeah.
And then Patrice O'Neill, the comic, like a whole different vibe. And he also passed away a few years ago. And our Patrice O'Neill is doing fine. She's
great. Lovely. That's right. So Patrice is alive and well and doing fine and still has the voice of an angel. Patrice O'Neill, rest in peace. The great comic. I love him. I thought he was hilarious. Anyway, Hillary, I've had an incredible time speaking to you. I hope this is the beginning of a new friendship and that we keep in touch. Please just, you know, let us know when your stuff comes out and we'll talk about it more. All right. Enjoy your morning or new. I guess it's still morning. It's still 11 o'clock for you, right?
It is.
Enjoy your morning.
Thank you.
I'm going to go teach some kids. That does it for my time with Hillary Field. I hope you enjoyed the show. I will see you guys next time. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support to support the show, and savageclassical.com, our sponsor of over 10 years, savageclassical.com, to get a guitar. See you guys next time.